National security secrets at risk from hackers, and not much hope for fixing it. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, July 16th. We go first today to South Korea, home of a very big corporate empire in the middle of a very big takeover fight. In one corner, Samsung. In the other, across the Pacific Ocean, a large U.S. hedge fund and major stakeholder, Elliott Associates. With any other company, you could boil this down to a battle between a founding family and its shareholders. But Samsung is a unique kind of company, and that means this isn't your typical takeover fight. Sally Herships reports.
Samsung is a special kind of company. Will Stofega is an analyst with IDC, a market research firm.
You have under one corporate umbrella a company that does everything from life insurance, hotels, construction.
And another thing, Stofega says in South Korea, Samsung is what's called a chaebol, a company founded and controlled by one family. Chaebols can be enormous. Just take Samsung.
It contributes roughly about 23% of Korea's GDP.
If you're a shareholder, that should sound pretty good. But remember, chaebols are controlled by a family.
That can be either good or bad. I mean, if the economic interests of the owners are aligned with shareholders, that can be a good thing.
David Larker teaches corporate governance at Stanford's Graduate School of Business. He says because of the family's interests and relationships, business decisions may not always be about profits for other shareholders.
Are you investing the money to increase value, or are you investing the money to maintain a family or business relationship that is longstanding?
IDC's Will Stofega believes given its size and connections, non-family shareholders don't have a strong chance to fight Samsung. And then there's culture. Usha Haley is an expert on East Asian governance. She says, bottom line, it may not make sense to expect foreign businesses to work like American ones.
So when culture meets legal regimes and legal rules, one or the other gives, and it's generally the legal regulations that do.
In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Now let's do a quick check-in on Greece. The latest today, the Greek parliament very reluctantly approved a package of cost-cutting measures, otherwise known as austerity. That led to some short-term bailout funds from the European Central Bank and European finance officials. So things are looking up, sort of. Germany's finance minister Wolfgang Schäuble still suggested today that Greece might just be better off outside the eurozone. So we'll keep an eye on it. Now on to another story about a country facing some financial issues, not one you might expect. Canada's central bank has cut its key interest rate and slashed its economic outlook in the second quarter, thanks to the impact of lower oil prices and weaker demand for exports. Now that could be troubling on its own, but it also marks the second straight quarter where Canada's GDP contracted. And that, my friends, is the textbook definition of the R word, recession. Marketplace's Adam Allington reports.
Canada made it through the financial crisis virtually intact. Now its good luck might be running out. But while two quarters of negative economic growth might be the, according to Hoyle, definition of a recession,
I'm really hesitant to call it a recession at this point.
Jeremy Kronick is a senior policy analyst at CD Howe, an economic policy think tank based in Toronto.
We have to have some duration of negative growth. We have to have, obviously, certain amplitude. But maybe more, even more importantly, we need it to be widespread.
Kronick points out that the downturn is largely caused by one industry, energy. Crude oil, found in Canada's western provinces, is the country's top export. Arlene Kish is a senior Canada economist for IHS. Despite the steep cutbacks in the oil industry, she says other sectors, such as retail and housing, are doing quite well.
So consumers are still out there spending. Incomes are still rising. So it's not as if we're facing any major challenges on the household front.
And since Canada's main trading partner, the United States, is still doing well, any threat to the broader North American economy usually runs from the United States north.
When they sneeze, we catch a cold, right? So when Canada has a recession, it's typically not going to be felt that big in the U.S.
Kish says low interest rates and a favorable exchange rate with the U.S. dollar should eventually boost the manufacturing sectors located in Ontario and Quebec, which are heavily vested in aerospace and the auto industry. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, good feelings about Greece, eBay, and Netflix. All the details when we do the numbers. Now, obviously, the big hack on the Federal Office of Personnel Management has been in the news lately, but it's not the first major cyber attack affecting a government agency. In a new series published this week in the Financial Times, two reporters, Kara Scannell and Gina Chon, detail some other disturbing attacks on the U.S. government against the Postal Service, the IRS, White House email systems, and even the Department of Energy. You know, the folks who look after our nuclear weapons. The series is called Cyber Insecurity. Today, Kara Scannell joins me to talk about just how big a problem the government's insecurity really is. Hi, Kara. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm sure no one's surprised that there are government inefficiencies when it comes to technology, but at what point does this become an actual national security issue?
I think with the OPM hack, this might be a particular moment where it hits to the issues of national security. Officials say that it was the Chinese that hacked into the network and that their goal is to build a database of Americans so that it can be used for blackmailing of people if they want to get someone inside a company to help with stealing intellectual property, or just to even map out who everyone is in the U.S., who their connections are, and who they might know overseas. But one of the big issues the federal government has, as is the private sector, is that they are working on such old technology and such old systems that some things can't be encrypted because they won't read.
Right.
So the federal government needs a complete overhaul of its architecture.
And how likely do you think that is after doing this reporting, after seeing some of the squabbles over budgeting? I mean, is it even possible to bring the government up to speed in any kind of rapid fashion?
I think that's a really, really big ask. I mean, Congress and getting the budget is an uphill battle. People don't want to put money into something that doesn't show immediate response. And so I think that's part of the issue. It's been, you know, kind of underfunded. And Congress did pass a law last year, which will give the chief information officer within the agencies some actual say on his own budget, which apparently was not the case before. So that should help some matters.
Wow.
But we're not talking about gobs of money going, you know, into, you know, IT to then create, you know, a brand new platform.
So maybe the theft of the extremely personal records of 22 million people will start a fire. Maybe.
Maybe. I mean, you do hear from people, both current and former, who are like, I'm part of that. And there's a sense of outrage that's starting to take shape because I don't think people really thought of these hacks as something that affected them. And then now you see, okay, 22 million people, current government officials, lawmakers who decide budgets are all part of that. So there's, you know, maybe now is the moment that we'll see a shift.
Maybe, like they say, all politics is local. Kara Scannell is a reporter with the Financial Times. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
Next up, a slightly different type of hacking. We all know someone who uses somebody else's password to stream Netflix or HBO to get out of paying that monthly fee. Maybe that someone is you. We won't make you admit it because lots of people do it. A Parks Associates study estimates folks like that cost the video on demand industry some $500 million worldwide. That free ride might be coming to an end soon. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more from New York on the possibility of a password sharing crackdown.
Viewers using borrowed Netflix passwords may find themselves pondering their ethics while watching Orange is the New Black.
When are you going to realize that you don't get to do whatever you want because it makes you feel good?
You are such a hypocrite.
No, you crossed a line.
Reasonable people may disagree. And however you may feel about password sharing, it actually doesn't matter all that much. That's because right now, the leaders of the major streaming services could crack down, but they aren't. James McQuivy of Forrester Research has an explanation.
This is a classic heroin model. It means you give people the first couple cracks at it for free, get them addicted, and then eventually hope that you can charge them for it.
Imagine your would-be addict as a college sophomore who hasn't quite cut the cord with mom and dad's membership. Once he has a job, it could be easier to figure out how to get him to subscribe if you already know what he likes to watch. Glenn Hauer is author of the Parks Associates report on just how much password sharing might be costing companies.
They are holding on to their data in order to use that in the future.
Hauer says about 20% of 18 to 24-year-olds that stream video don't pay for it. But they shouldn't get too used to a world where big media companies look the other way. Dan Rayburn is digital media analyst with Frost & Sullivan.
I'm kind of surprised that at this point, considering how big some of these services have gotten in terms of the number of subscribers, that they haven't actually cracked down on it. But I think it's only a matter of time before they do.
Good or evil, enjoy it while it lasts. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Coming up,
there's one thing that we all do for many hours every day that has generally escaped their scrutiny.
What could it be? What could it be? But first, let's do the numbers. And those numbers are up. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose 70 points, nearly 0.4%, to close at 18,120. The NASDAQ charged up 64%, 1.25%, to finish at 5163. The S&P 500 picked up 16 points, or 0.8%, to end the day at 2124. We're really in the thick of corporate earnings season now. Citigroup had its highest quarterly profit in 8 years, thanks in part to a big drop in legal costs. Shares soared 3.7%. Same story, but in reverse for Goldman Sachs Group, which said its profit was the smallest it's been in 4 years, as it set aside money for potential mortgage settlements. Shares were off 0.8%. Bonds are steady. The yield on the 10-year T-note is at 2.35%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department reports on construction of new homes in June. The Labor Department releases a consumer price index for June. And the 2015 Rubik's Cube World Championship gets underway in Brazil. Competitors are blindfolded in some events. How do you peel the stickers off and rearrange them if you can't see them? I'm Michelle Phillippe.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood in for Kai Rizdal. A lot of talk about sanctions lately. Iran's have been lifted after a deal for nuclear oversight this week. By some estimates, that could bring about $100 billion into the country. Russia is on the opposite end of the spectrum. It's been experiencing economic sanctions for nearly a year. Olga Smirnova of the BBC Russian Service has been reporting on how the sanctions have affected Russia. Olga, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
So what is the mood around these sanctions? Is there a sense that they're working?
Well, I've just attended a conference which is called The Scary New World, How to Do Business in a World Without Order. And there were many representatives of European business and many politicians. And they thought they were working. For example, Anne-Marie Slaughter, the president of New America Foundation, stressed that sanctions are a very effective deterrent. We shouldn't forget that sanctions have a very important political role. And from mm-hmm. that point of view, they have worked. They have shown that Europe is united as a deterrent, as a political measure. Mm-hmm. They are working. It's a different question if we're talking about economics.
Yes. And that had been the question a bit, how effective the sanctions would be toward the Russian government versus toward the Russian people. Was that addressed at all?
Yes. Well, of course, we should remember that it's virtually impossible to disentangle the economic effect of falling oil prices and deflation of the ruble from the sanctions themselves. Russia, it was stressed at the convention, is a developing economy and it doesn't have its own capital. It needs access to foreign capital. And that access has been denied.
And so how will we know when these sanctions can be considered successful? How would governments or world leaders define eventual success and maybe an end to sanctions?
I think for the participants of the convention, that would be non-interference by Russian regime in the post-Soviet space. That this mm-hmm. is the first unified action by the West to any aggression in post-Soviet state. So if in the future we don't have that kind of interference, that's probably one sign of the success.
So the sense is that they're working now, but there's no timeline for ending them.
Yes, the sense that I had that we're there in the long haul. Olli Rehn, the Minister of Economic Affairs of Finland, stressed that, Russia has, however we don't like it, but it has a pretty stable regime at the moment. And it looks like Putin is entrenched. And to a degree, he has been strengthened by the sanctions because he now can absolve responsibility from the economic crisis. So from that point of view, there is a certain stability in that system. So, we're there for long haul.
It sounds like it. Olga Smirnov, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
Now, back in 2004, in his State of the Union address, President George W. Bush pledged millions more for schools to test their students for drug use. Extra government grants to help fund drug testing in schools were easy to come by. Congress took away funding for those programs in 2011, and there's been a lot of debate about how effective they were. But drug testing programs are still popular in schools around the country. From Birmingham, Alabama, Gigi Duban has this story.
Hayes Johnson has six kids. At home in Vestavia Hills near Birmingham on a recent morning, she and two of her kids, 6-year-old Joseph and 16-year-old Celeste, are busy cleaning up the breakfast remains. Syrup and marshmallow fluff and bacon. When she started high school, Celeste wanted to do theater. She wanted to play lacrosse, join the French club. So at the beginning of her freshman year, she and her parents had a little talk about drug tests.
We discussed it with her and said, this is something that can happen.
That's because Vestavia Hills High School, where Celeste will be a junior this year, has been testing kids in extracurricular activities for about 10 years. For Celeste, and for many students across the country, athletes and kids in everything from chess club to debate team, school drug testing is just part of the deal. Almost 30% of public schools drug test their students, according to the CDC.
But our latest addition is our voluntary drug testing program.
David Howard oversees drug testing at Vestavia Hills City Schools. The new program opens up drug testing to any student.
Basically, if you're going to sign up for it, we're going to drug test you.
If a child tests positive, parents are told, and they have to show a board of review what they've done to help their child. Kids who come up clean get a certificate. Other school systems offer incentives like discounts on ice cream and free bowling. Howard thinks these programs are important. He says a few of their graduates have died of heroin overdoses in recent years. And he says the downward spiral leading to that starts in high school.
We made that offering to parents because we just want to equip them with the information that maybe something is going on.
To sign up, parents pay $40 a year. The random testing program for kids in extracurriculars costs the school system about $1,500 a month. That's a big financial hit, and the costs can go up if more kids sign up for activities.
If numbers go up, we just have to tackle it on multiple days with maybe more testers.
Drug testing is a multi-billion dollar industry. But in schools, it's not clear the expense and the interrupted class time are worth it, according to Lynn Goldberg. He's professor of medicine at the Oregon Health and Science University, and he's studied school drug testing.
If it's used primarily as a deterrent, there's not a lot of real good evidence that it works that way.
Research shows while drug testing is associated with a very modest decline in marijuana use, surveys sometimes find an increase in the use of other drugs. How? For one thing, drug tests aren't always accurate. Case in point, Goldberg says, Marion Jones and Lance Armstrong.
And there are times that they don't test. They don't test in the summer. They don't test over vacations. They don't test on the weekends.
And kids know this. Just ask Celeste, Hayes Johnson's daughter.
I think that if a kid really wants to be using drugs, they're going to find some way to evade it.
The Johnsons haven't opted into the new drug testing program. Because they do extracurriculars, they're already subject to random testing. But Hayes Johnson questions the randomness. In 5 years, her kids haven't been tested once.
But we have friends who have children who do the exact same extracurriculars, who have tested every year or multiple times a year.
Not to mention, she says, a friend's son tested positive for amphetamines. Turned out, it was his ADHD medicine. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
All right, enough about drug testing and cyber doom. Let's have a little fun, shall we? It's time for some Freakonomics. It's Stephen Dubner is co-host of the Freakonomics Radio podcast, which comes out every Thursday and explores the hidden side of everything. Stephen, glad to talk to you.
Hey, Molly, you too. You know, economists, as you probably know, scrutinize just about every human activity. But there's one thing that we all do for many hours every day that has generally escaped their scrutiny. Any guesses what this might be?
Fantasize about what you would do if you won the lottery?
I'm going to give you a hint.
Oh.
Yep, sleeping. Here is the economist Matthew Gibson.
Economists have historically, or over the long span of history, have treated sleep as something to be ignored, something outside the realm of economics.
I mean, I guess that makes sense. When you're sleeping, you're not working. That seems to be something that economists would care more about.
Maybe so, but, you know, there are a lot of health implications to how well you sleep. And you could also imagine that sleep has a lot to do with how well you work, how much money you make. One problem, however, is that it's not so easy to get good data on something like how much people sleep.
It's quite difficult to get accurate information about people's routine sleep behavior.
That's Diane Lauderdale. She's an epidemiologist at the University of Chicago. And she says that a lot of sleep data traditionally comes from surveys.
One approach people in surveys unfortunately often resort to is just giving an answer which they think will be a well-accepted answer to the person interviewing them.
Or maybe it's a little denial. It's the answer that the person hopes is true.
Exactly, yeah. But we are starting to get better data now, in part through better surveys. There's the American Time Use Survey, which is really handy, but also through little monitors that people wear around their wrists, things like that.
Right, but so if sleep researchers are getting better data, what do those data actually have to say? I feel like everybody collects information about sleep, but what can you do with it?
All right, let me tell you a little bit of what we know. Americans sleep on average 8 to 9 hours a night, a little bit more if you're an immigrant. Women sleep about 8 minutes more per night than men, unless there is a baby in the house, in which case women sleep less. Single people sleep about 8 minutes more per night than married people.
And could differences in sleep also help explain income disparities?
You know, absolutely. So you look for proof. There's a really neat study done by a pair of economists who thought, wouldn't it be cool if we could run a giant sleep experiment across America to see whether sleep affects wages? Here again is Matthew Gibson.
And it turns out that ever since we've put time zones into place, we've basically been running just that sort of giant experiment on everyone in America.
So Molly, Gibson and his co-author Jeffrey Schrader looked at similar populations that lie at opposite ends of a time zone. So you take a city like Huntsville, Alabama, which is on the eastern edge of the central time zone, and Amarillo, Texas, which is on the western edge. So even though cities like this are on the same clock, the same hour, and the same time zone, the western city gets roughly an hour more sunlight, which means that people there tend to go to bed later. But they have to wake up at the same time as the people in the eastern city. So on average, they get less sleep. And that allowed Gibson to look at the wage data in places like this to see how an extra dose of sleep affects incomes.
And we find that permanently increasing sleep by an hour per week for everybody in a city increases the wages in that location by about 4.5%.
That is fascinating. That's a substantial difference. And I say that as a West Coaster. Are you saying that if we or even I want to increase my productivity and wages, maybe even GDP, that we should all be going to sleep earlier?
Look, it's not like I'm making this up. I'm not the first one to say early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. But it's good to know the data back it up, right?
I guess so. It seems like good news for the sleeping pill industry, too, perhaps. Stephen J. Dubner is the host of Freakonomics Radio podcast with a new episode out today. Stephen, thanks so much for coming on.
Molly, thanks for having me.
This final note before we go, if you're riding around in Ubers in New York City today, you may have noticed a car option that wasn't there before. Down there next to Uber T and Uber Pool and Uber X is the de Blasio. If you tap on it, you'll see a message urging Uber users to call Mayor de Blasio and the city council to protest de Blasio's proposal to cap the number of new Uber cars that will be allowed in New York City. The mayor's office argues that all the new Uber cars on the road are making Manhattan traffic, which is pretty bad, even worse. Uber claims it's being bullied by the city to protect the taxi industry. There have been TV ads, leaflets, all saying that a crackdown would hurt commuters and workers alike. And now there's the de Blasio tab, which also lets you simulate how long your wait for an Uber car might be if the mayor's plan goes forward. Meanwhile, I hear there's a very nice system of trains running underneath the entire place. All right, that's it. That's our show for today. A good day on Wall Street. The Dow was up 70 points, nearly 0.4%. The NASDAQ up 64 points, 1.25%. And the S&P 500 picked up 16 points, 0.8%. Golda Arthur, Kate Kincannon, John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, George Judson, Dave Shaw, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. Our managing editor is Mark Miller. I'm Molly Wood. Kai Rizdahl is over the jet lag and back in the host chair tomorrow. Have a great evening, everyone. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.